Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we explore how a little-known international bank influences the world's economy. Then, amid the brutal war in Syria, we analyze the psychology that drives human atrocities and the means to prevent them. Switzerland is home to a little-known international bank. It's not an ordinary bank, but rather a bank for bankers. Our next guest says it has enormous influence over economies. Adam Labor joins us now. He's a journalist and the author of Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World. Welcome, Adam Labor. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Why don't you start us with an explanation about what exactly this bank is? It's called the Bank of Settlements. Why is it called that, and what exactly does it do?
Well, the Bank for International Settlements was originally founded in 1930 to manage German reparations payments for the First World War. That means the monies that the victorious Allies, including the United States, decided that the Germans had to pay for their role in the First World War. But by 1932, Germany wasn't paying German reparations payments anymore, but the bank was still there, and it's still there now. And the real reason it was founded was to have a place for central bankers to meet, away from nosy politicians and prying reporters. And the bank was founded by an international treaty, which means that it's the only commercial bank in the world. It makes profits. It's a profit-making organization, but it also has the same status as the United Nations or an embassy, so it's almost extraterritorial. The Swiss authorities have no right to enter the bank's headquarters in Basel, for example, without the permission of the management.
So who gets the profits?
The bank keeps some of its profits and pays out some of its profits to its shareholders, who are its member banks, the 60 member banks, the 60 member central banks. That includes, for example, the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Italy, France, Bundesbank, and so on. But what's really interesting about it nowadays is that every 2 months, all the central bankers of the world, such as Ben Bernanke and Mervyn King from the Bank of England and Mario Draghi from the European Central Bank, meet there in some conditions of some secrecy. For example, no journalists are even allowed in the building for those 2 days while those meetings go on. And they talk about monetary policy, which means how the bank, the central bank or the Federal Reserve governs the money supply and decide and helps kind of decide the value of money. So the discussions that they have there are very relevant to us because they get ideas from each other, they exchange ideas with each other, talk about different policies, how to implement them. The bank's been very important during the recent crisis. But we don't know anything about these discussions. They're all top secret.
So in essence, what you're saying is this is a quasi-public institution in a way because it's created by international treaty. It's supposed to have some sort of public purpose, but it has no public oversight.
Exactly. Yeah, you've got it in one. The people that work there in the bank itself says it has a kind of mission of public service to serve central banks. But it doesn't really have any oversight. I mean, the oversight is, in a sense, I guess, the shareholders, same as in any commercial organization, but the shareholders are the people who set the bank up for their own interests. So it sort of goes round in a circle. And as I say in the book, when they set the bank up, they launch the bank with the capital, the central banks put the money in to have the share capital, then they buy the shares, and then it makes a profit very quickly because, you know, everyone wants to do business with the Bank for International Settlements because its shareholders are central banks. You know, it's never going to go bust, really, or it's highly unlikely. You know, it has a AAA gold, triple plus credit rating nowadays. You know, I mean, exaggerating, but, you know, the top class credit rating. So it's a perpetual money machine, but it has no real democratic or meaningful oversight.
Is that very different from, say, its member banks like the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England? Don't they also have a great deal of secrecy around them?
Well, they have some secrecy about their operations, and I understand that they need to have some secrecy because if, you know, Ben Bernanke said that he's going to, you know, do this with interest rates or do that with interest rates in a globalized instant response economy, that information, you know, if someone knew that before it was public, would be worth a lot of money because you could, you know, long and short the dollar and do all sorts of things. But the point is that Ben Bernanke is accountable to Congress and to the US government. I mean, Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, you know, is accountable to the British government. And they're acting in a way, you know, in coordination, although they're independent. They're obviously kind of in touch and discussing and coordinating things, you know, with the US Treasury and with the Chancellor of the Exchequer in Britain. whereas the BIS just goes off on its own. I mean, it doesn't organize big interventions in the markets to raise interest rates up and down and that kind of thing. But what it does do is act as a meeting point. And my point is that we need to know a bit more information about these meetings, because we don't know who attends, we don't know what's discussed, and we don't know the themes of those discussions. Now, the bankers say, oh, you know, if you put a camera in the room or you issued a transcript, then nobody would say anything because they didn't want to say things on the record. You know, they sort of present a ridiculous scenario as to why nothing can be done. And I say, look, I understand that you need to have some confidentiality. Of course you do. But also, you know, we are paying you. A central banker is not working for JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs. He's a public servant. And we want to know where you are. We want to know who goes to these meetings. And we want to know the broad themes of the discussion of those meetings.
Now, you listed in your book several countries that are actually engaged in the meetings. What countries are excluded? And then there's also these countries that can observe but can't speak. How does all that work?
Well, it's very hierarchical, probably partly because the bank is based in Switzerland and has been there since 1930, so it's taken on, you know, the Swiss love of order and culture and hierarchy and secrecy. So what happens is the meetings take place every 2 months. The bank has 60 member banks. Well, the 60 central bankers all land in Zurich Airport, and they're brought by a fleet of limousines to Basel, and they obviously stay in a five-star hotel. And during the week, you know, they usually arrive on a Saturday or Sunday, maybe stay till Monday night or the Tuesday morning. And during that time, they're all very, very well looked after with wonderful food and the finest wines and so on and so forth. So the most important meeting is on the Sunday night. That's called the Economic Consultative Meeting. And that's the board of directors of the bank, which is, you know, the governors of the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the Bank of France, the Bank of Italy, plus the general manager of the bank, who is a former governor of the Bank of Spain, plus the governors of India, the national banks of India and Brazil. And so there's 18 or so of them, and they have that meeting, which goes on till late, and then they have a dinner. And the next day, there's something called the Global Economy Meeting, which is 30 countries attend that and sit around a big table. And that's bigger countries like Turkey and Indonesia, for example, attend that. And then another 15 or so countries, sort of middle-sized countries, like, for example, Hungary and Poland, I think, can attend but don't really speak. But and then the last 15 aren't even allowed to attend. They just have to hang around outside, like the very small countries like Slovakia and Slovenia. But what's interesting is that, you know, after 1989 and the collapse of communism, all these tiny countries like Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania and Slovakia and Slovenia, they're all let in. You know, and their total population is like 16 million people. But Pakistan is not a member of the BIS, you know, with 180 million people. In Africa, only Algeria and South Africa are members. There's Nigeria is not a member of the BIS. Kazakhstan is not a member of the BIS. Now, it's still very Eurocentric.
And what's the justification for that?
Well, they say governance, the BIS demands certain standards of governance, and obviously, you know, transparency in the way the central banks are run and the way the country is run. But, you know, I mean, there's China and Russia and Saudi Arabia are members of the BIS, and there's, you know, all sorts of questions you can raise about, you know, transparency and economic governance in China and Russia, for example. So, you know, it's still a very Eurocentric, perhaps we could even speak frankly and say it's a very kind of white-dominated organization.
Well, let's back up to the root of the BIS. And at the root of it was a man named Montagu Norman. Who was he?
Well, the bank was set up essentially by Montagu Norman, who was the governor of the Bank of England from 1920 to 1944, and Hjalmar Schacht, who was the president of the Reichsbank, which was the central bank of Germany. And during the 1930s, Schacht was an extremely important figure. He continued serving under Hitler, and then he became the Minister of Economics. And he was generally regarded as the man, you know, who constructed the so-called, you know, first German economic miracle, bringing people in from unemployment and getting Germany back on the road after the devastation of the First World War, and essentially building the Nazi war machine, and was indeed put on trial in Nuremberg after the Second World War for, you know, being the financial genius behind the Nazi empire, which he was, and then he was acquitted, oddly enough.
Now, that wasn't Montagu Norman, that was Schacht, right?
Yeah, sorry, that was Schacht, but Norman was the governor of the Bank of England from 1920 to 1944. He's extremely close to Schacht, and that relationship was really the relationship that built up the bank. I mean, Schacht used to call the bank my bank, and Norman was one of the very first people to help set it up.
Now, Norman was thought to have been rebuilding Europe, creating financial cooperation. He thought that would be beneficial for the world. Do you have a sense of his philosophy and his plan and how it was materialized?
Well, yes. You know, there is an argument. There is a case for the defense. I mean, the people like Schacht and Norman think that, you know, stupid politicians get us into war, and what we really need to do is just do lots of business and keep the money flowing. This was the kind of the start of the financial globalization that you see nowadays, that, you know, a lot of money is sloshing around. The BIS helped organize bailouts for Spain and Hungary and Austria when some of the banks were in trouble. So this is the start of it. But at the same time, there's a real arrogance that goes with that. You know, we know what's best. You silly politicians and little people, you don't know anything. Just leave it to us and we'll organize things. So what you end up with is this sense of kind of celestial mission. And I think, you know, I use the word arrogance, and I think it's correct. Now, for example, in March 1939, Nazi Germany invaded Czechoslovakia. And SS officers marched over to the governor of the National Bank in Prague, the Czechoslovak National Bank, and said, you've got 23 tons of gold in the BIS, actually held in the BIS subaccount of the Bank of England. You know, the gold wasn't physically in Prague, it was physically in London, but it was credited to the BIS. And they say, we want it. You send an order to London and to Basel saying, transfer this gold to the subaccount of the Reichsbank. So obviously, I mean, they've literally got Lugers pointed at their heads. They send the order. And what happens, it's crystal clear that any order coming from Prague to say, send 23 tons of our gold to Nazi Germany after Nazi Germany is invaded, is going to be issued under duress. But Norman was absolutely instrumental in making sure that that money was transferred to Nazi Germany. And the BIS was just said, oh, well, you know, the paperwork's in order. We've got the order from... I mean, they hummed and hawed a bit, but they essentially took the position that the paperwork's in order. And off the gold went without a shot being fired. So, you know, there's this sense that, you know, we, the bankers, know what's best, and we have to keep the channels open and move the money around. And it doesn't really matter if there's two SS officers standing behind someone pointing a gun at them. We just follow the paperwork.
One of the interesting things about this gentleman, Schacht, that you have been writing about is that even while he was propping up Nazi Germany, he did not necessarily agree with the Nazi philosophy.
No, he wasn't a believing Nazi, you know, kind of strutting around like an SS officer. He was an old-fashioned German nationalist and an authoritarian. He wasn't a liberal democrat, but he wasn't a believer in all the Nazi theories of racial supremacy. And he had Jewish friends. I mean, some of his best friends really were Jewish. But he, like many people, thought that Hitler was, you know, was rather unsavory and unpleasant and not ideal. But he was the best option to save Germany, because at that time in Europe, people were very worried about the rise of communism and the Soviet Union. And Germany almost had a civil war and a kind of revolution, and the Weimar Republic collapsed. And they said, we need order and stability. And Hitler's rather ghastly, but we'll hold our nose and we'll go with him. In Schacht's defense, eventually he broke with him. And in 1944, he was actually sent to Dachau, a concentration camp where he was, and he was moved around various concentration camps and was eventually liberated by the Allies.
He was not found guilty of war crimes, but did some of the BIS directors get charged? You noted that there were five that were charged. Were any convicted?
Yes, five BIS directors were charged. And the five were Schacht himself, Hermann Schmitz, who was the boss of a company called IG Farben, which was the biggest Nazi industrial and chemical conglomerate, which ran its own corporate concentration camp at Auschwitz and also manufactured Zyklon B, the gas used to murder the Jews. He was found guilty and he got a very short sentence, I think 3 or 4 years, of which he served very little. A German private banker called Kurt von Schroeder was put on trial, who was a BIS board member. And the president, Schacht's successor as the president of the Reichsbank, Walter Funk, and his deputy, Emil Poole, also a BIS director. They were both put on trial, and they were found guilty, but all of these people served quite short sentences, and many of them were released, thanks in large part to John McCloy, who was the governor of Germany, and Alan Dulles, who pushed very, very hard behind the scenes for German industrialists to serve token sentences and then be released to rebuild the German economy as a bulwark against the Soviet Union.
Let's go back to Alan Dulles, because you had quite a bit in your book, Tower of Babel, about him. First of all, how would you describe Alan Dulles, and what would you say his whole role in this bank was, including this era with Nazi Germany?
Well, Dulles is a very fascinating figure. Alan Dulles and his brother, John Foster Dulles, were really key figures in the 1930s of the money channel that ran between Wall Street and Berlin. Now, they were both lawyers for Sullivan and Cromwell, which had an enormous amount of clients in Germany, from private companies to, they were working with various merchant banks and investment banks in the States, you know, doing the deals and funneling money to, you know, municipalities to rebuild trams and do commercial investments. And there was nothing illegal in this. And lots of, you know, British banks and French banks, where people were trading with Germany. But during the war, Dulles was very close friends with Thomas McKittrick, who is the American banker who was the president of the BIS from 1940 to 46. And McKittrick and also a man called Roger Aubois, who was the bank's general manager, were both assets of Alan Dulles. I think McKittrick was, you know, code number 644 and Aubois was 650. And they were in very close touch. McKittrick was close friends with Dulles. I found some very interesting documents in the archives of the Office for Strategic Services that show how McKittrick in 1944 was in contact with German industrialists. And what he's saying to them is that, you know, cooperate with us and don't make trouble, essentially, when we invade. You know, the war's over. But be helpful to us, and we'll make sure, this is in print, in writing, that we will guarantee your profits after the Second World War, and we won't decartelize you, because there was pressure at the time to break up, you know, these giant conglomerates, you know, big German firms that were very much part of the whole Nazi war machine. And the shocking thing is that this isn't some kind of wild personal initiative of McKittrick or Dulles. All this is taking place with the full knowledge of the State Department and the Office of Strategic Services, which is why Harry Dexter White and Henry Morgenthau hated the BIS and wanted it closed down. And they were kind of fighting with McKittrick and Dulles over this. And Harry Dexter White said, you know, while our boys are fighting the Germans, McKittrick's doing business with the Germans. And it's completely true. And during the Second World War, the BIS accepted a lot of looted Nazi gold from Germany and also did a lot of foreign exchange deals for them. The BIS was so useful to Nazi Germany that it was described by Emil Poole, who was the vice president of the Nazi Reichsbank and a BIS director, as the only real foreign branch of the Reichsbank. So the only real foreign branch of the Reichsbank had an American president.
It's quite fascinating, isn't it?
It really is, and it's actually quite shocking.
Quite shocking.
Because, you know, we know what happened at D-Day and at the Battle of the Bulge and at Arnhem, and how many American and Allied soldiers were killed. And while this was going on, this incredible cynicism of, you know, yeah, well, whatever, let's keep the money connections open.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Scholar's Circle and The Insiders, and we're speaking with Adam Labor about his book, Tower of Babel. Let's talk for a bit about where this bank is located. It was initially behind a chocolate shop, unnoticeable.
It was very Swiss and very 1930s. It was set up in a former hotel, the Grand Hotel Savoy Universe, I think was the full title of it, near Basel Railway Station. And, of course, it had no sign or no real sign saying, you know, this is the Bank for International Settlements. You got in there through a little doorway next to a chocolate shop. Now, the feeling was if you needed to know where the bank was, you would know where it was. And if you didn't, then you certainly had no business looking for it. And so it was set up there, and it was, you know, Switzerland was the obvious choice in a way, really. There was some talk of putting it in Amsterdam or London or Brussels, but, you know, Switzerland is neutral, and it had a very strong tradition of banking and banking secrecy. So that seemed to be the kind of logical place to put it. It stayed in Basel. It moved not very far away to its new address, which is at Zentralbahnplatz 2. It's a very strange 18-story circular building with tinted windows that overlooks a very busy road on one side and overlooks the train station on the other side. And it's got all the flags out of its member nations, like a kind of mini United Nations. And that's why I call it the Tower of Basel, because it is a tower and it's in Basel. And when you go inside, there's very high security. You have to go through all these double doors and, you know, get passed in and everything like that. It was built in the 1970s. It's got this really strange 1970s feel. It's sort of globular furniture, you know, that, you know, you could sell all that furniture in the East Village, I think, probably for a lot of money. There's this very retro furniture and these looping circular corridors. It's got this sort of slightly Goldfinger-y James Bond feel to it. It's a very interesting building in a way, it's architecturally.
How much time did you actually get to spend there?
Well, I spent some time, quite a while in the archives. A week I spent in the archives. But, you know, when you're in there, it's very tightly controlled. I mean, give them credit, the archives are open to all legitimate researchers under the 30-year rule, which means that the documents up until 30 years ago are open, unless there are things like, you know, personnel files or something like that, which is confidential. But, you know, a lot of the bank's history and records and what it's done is all there. And they were helpful, very helpful to me. But, you know, it's funny, you go in and you sit in the archive room and you put your requests in and the files come up. And at 12:30, you have to leave the building because the bank shuts for lunch between 12:30 and 2, like a good Swiss European institution. And then you can come back in at 2 o'clock, but you're escorted everywhere. If you want, you're allowed to go to the toilet on your own or to get a drink of water. I mean, look, the place is blanketed in CCTV cameras anyway. So, you know, when I went to the library, you're escorted to the library. You want to leave the library, you must be called and someone will come and get you. And, of course, the journalist in me wanted to kind of just ride the lifts up and down, and especially on the last day, and see what would happen. But then, you know, I didn't do that because I wouldn't be responsible, because the archivist was nice and helpful. So I wanted to be respectful in that sense. But, of course, you know, you're very curious what's going on these other floors.
Now, although you're allowed to go through the archives, you've noted that there aren't really minutes for the meetings.
The meetings that take place over the weekend, no, there's no minutes taken of those. The only minutes that are taken are the board of directors, which is stuff to do with the bank governance, like, I don't know, things to do with personnel and the admin of the bank, obviously, minutes are taken of those.
Let's talk about some sort of concrete examples of what this bank has actually managed to do post-World War II. You gave some concrete examples. One was in the 1960s on the London Gold Pool. What exactly happened?
One of the main things about the Bank for International Settlements is that it's a meeting place, and it's a protected meeting place where, you know, nobody has any authority there. It's extraterritorial. So the bankers feel that they can, you know, really sit and take some decisions there and have very in-depth discussions without having to be accountable to anybody. So the London Gold Pool was a means by which the different central banks, you know, just agreed a series of maneuvers to keep the price of gold at $35 an ounce. And you could say, you know, that's what was set out at Bretton Woods, which was a democratic meeting of the Allied powers. So they were just maneuvering the markets in that sense to keep the price stable. But what I thought was very interesting was the bank's role behind the scenes in constructing the euro. The preparations for the euro started in the late 1940s, essentially, because you can't just slam all these currencies like the lira and the franc and the Deutschmark together. You have to, you know, stabilize them and reduce the exchange rate fluctuations and keep them in exchange rate bands and try and hold those bands. And all of this was done at the BIS in very obscure things that most people have never heard of, like the European Payments Union and the European Monetary Cooperation Fund, and the Governors Committee meetings were held there, the Committee of the Governors of the European Central Banks. And then crucially, in the late 1980s, the Delors Committee, which laid out the serious plan for European Monetary Union and the Euro, met at the BIS, you know, and it wasn't part of the BIS, but it physically met there. It was serviced by the BIS, and one of its most important members was a man called Alexandre Lamfalussy, who was the governor of the BIS, who was the general manager of the BIS. And he's known as the father of the euro because basically he was one of the few people that understood what was needed to get this single European currency together. So the BIS has been absolutely integral to the whole euro project.
We will continue our conversation with Adam Labor about the Tower of Basel, the Bank of International Settlements, next week. When we come back, understanding the roots of lethal violence and cruelty. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Although war and armed conflict are declining on a global level, atrocities, cruelty, and lethal violence continue in many parts of the world. What is driving people to commit lethal violence? What justifies human cruelty? And what can bystanders and others do to prevent their continuation? Three experts join us now. Irvin Staub is a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. His books include The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism, which is just coming out in paperback. David Livingston Smith is a professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He's the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, and Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. John Cagg also joins us. He is professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. He's the author of Neoconservative Images of the United Nations, American Domestic Politics and International Cooperation, and co-author of Philosophical Pragmatism and International Relations. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. David Livingston Smith, I want to start with you. You have made an assertion in your book, Less Than Human, that really came from Jane Goodall, that human beings are the only animals capable of cruelty. You've agreed with her. What's the evidence?
Well, it's not so much a matter of evidence, but although it is partially, it's a matter of how we think about the meaning of cruelty. Of course, all sorts of creatures inflict pain on other creatures. The natural world is a pretty nasty place. But to be cruel, I think you have to know what you're doing in the first instance. That is, you have to have the notion not only of pain, actually, but I think more to the point of harm. So cruelty involves deliberate harm. That is, you have to desire to do harm, and you have to believe that by carrying out a certain set of actions, you will succeed in doing harm. And I don't think any other creature has the cognitive horsepower to engage in that sort of thinking.
You've talked about this process of dehumanization. Is that the connection, the moral disengagement that's involved with that, that then links to cruelty?
Yes, sure. So from the outside, of course, dehumanization results in acts which seem quite cruel. But when we dehumanize others, what's going on is that we exclude them from the universe of moral consideration. We morally disengage from them, as you said. So from the dehumanizer standpoint, I think for the most part, the actions aren't seen as cruel. They're seen rather as morally obligatory.
In other words, you're doing a service in some way.
You're doing a service to humanity from your point of view. If you look at the genocides that have unfolded, say, over the past century and no doubt before then, the perpetrators of genocide and other terrible atrocities typically represent what they're doing in moralistic terms. They're doing the world a service. They're eliminating some evil or giving these monstrous creatures what they deserve.
Sounds like a little bit of a slippery slope no matter what. Irvin Staub, let's bring you in. You've been studying political violence, mass violence for a very long time. You've come up with a whole theory around what goes on for people that this occurs and even a set of conditions. What would you add to this?
Well, it's very true that perpetrators usually see what they do as something positive. Social conditions that are very difficult and conflict between groups are often a starting point. And out of that, frequently some vision arises. I call this a destructive ideology in which people try to improve the situation of their group, but they see some other group as standing in the way. And there is an evolution that begins, a social, psychological, behavioral evolution in which people begin to harm these other people. And in the course of that, they change, and the society changes, and new institutions are created. And then it is not only moral exclusion and moral disengagement, but there is a reversal of morality. Killing these people becomes the right thing to do. And the bystanders, people in the society who are neither the perpetrators themselves nor members of the victim group, but are onlookers, and they are often complicit, in part by just simply go along as everything was normal. You know, in Germany, people stopped going to buy things in Jewish stores, they stopped relating to Jewish people, they disengaged from Jewish friends, and in that way, they in a way supported the system, and this encourages perpetrators. And people on the outside are often passive. You know, the United States has been passive in relation to many very horrendous events, including the genocide in Rwanda, where I have been working during the genocide, but afterwards for a number of years on reconciliation. And this passivity allows the unfolding of this evolution, as I was talking about. So in order to prevent these things, it's extremely important for people within a society to become resistant. This is not easy, because in difficult times, or when there is conflict between groups, people need their own groups. So to resist this process, to resist this evolution, to have moral courage to speak out, to have ways to connect with other people and try to do something is very challenging. It's not so challenging for outsiders. They could engage in action relatively early, before military action is necessary to stop these processes. But unfortunately, we normally observe, stand by, don't do anything, especially when there is only smoke and no huge fire yet.
I'm going to want to go back to this in just a bit, Irvin Staub, and I'd like to put some hard examples on it. In the current age, for example, what's going on in Syria, like what examples of that may be. Before we go there, though, I wanted to bring John Kagg in to talk about this process of technologizing conflict in a way to try to distance and deal with issues of dehumanization. John Kagg, you've looked specifically at the issue of drone warfare, and you've raised concerns about the impact on both individuals and societies. What do you think those are?
Primary motivation for me to begin thinking about drones occurred about 3 years ago. And an economist actually came up to me and said, "Do you think that drone warfare constitutes what economists generally know as a moral hazard?" In this case, we're talking about the use of drones in targeted killings, primarily in the Pakistan region. I thought about it a little bit, and I thought that she was onto something. A moral hazard is basically a situation in which a party or a person is willing to take on greater risks, primarily moral or practical risks, when they do not have to shoulder the consequences associated with those risks. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that precision-guided munitions and the U.S. use of unmanned aerial vehicles constitute a moral hazard to the extent that these technologies protect U.S. troops and also limit the cost of war. In a certain respect, this is a good thing, but this is definitely a mixed blessing because it allows policymakers to conduct operations without the standard oversight, and we've seen this with the case of drones, without the oversight that previous wars and very costly wars oftentimes require from their citizenry. As I sort of worked through this problem in 2011 and 2012, more data came in about the way in which the U.S. populace was not actually concerned about what was happening in the tribal regions or with targeted killings. Only 9% disapprove of what's happening with drones in those regions. In comparison, 52% of Americans care what happens when it comes to surveillance with drones in the domestic setting. And those numbers sort of shocked me and also resonate closely with the findings that Irvin and David have when it comes to othering a population and then feeling willing to exterminate this population for the sake of humanity. It's a pleasure to talk to both of them about this.
We've got this new technology, and then we've got old technology that we saw, say, in Rwanda. People were up close and personal using every mode of cruelty they could possibly use, machetes and hammers and boiling water and the spread of AIDS, and they made their other suffer. What could the U.S. have done in that circumstance to prevent the genocide? And what could it be doing in today's conflicts? Irvin Staub?
The U.S. could have done many things, and the international community could have done many things. I think, for example, that simply putting some kind of substantial military force on the border of Rwanda could have stopped the genocide. when the RPA, the Tutsi army, that finally stopped the genocide was moving near an area. The killing in that area stopped. They didn't even have to enter that area. Instead, what we did was we sent all Western countries, sent military in there to take out its own citizens and go away, which was basically telling people that they can do whatever they will. Now, what can we do in some other situations? Situations are extremely challenging often, admittedly, especially when you don't act early. So, for example, in the Sudan right now, there are areas, the Blue Nile region and another region, where the government is bombing villages, killing people. There are a huge number of refugees. The Sudanese government doesn't allow humanitarian aid to come in to them, and as a result, there is the danger of starvation. Now, minimally, we should focus the searchlight of the international community on that. Point to it. Talk about it. Sudan has already done many things, and the president of Sudan, Bashir, has been already indicted by the International Criminal Court for human rights violations and genocide. So that makes it more problematic. But nonetheless, people respond to the condemnation and the concern and the attention of the international community, and that's the minimum that we could do. And if that doesn't have effect, at least allowing humanitarian aid, then we could move to other things. You know, we have now an atrocities prevention board that was established last year, I believe, by our president. It was recommended by a commission by Albright and Cohen. It's an interagency board. There is no clear indication of what that board has done since it has been established. Samantha Power was the chair of that board, the head of that board. I think that when there are no confirmation hearings for her as UN ambassador, it would be good to ask her what that board has done and also what that board could do in these situations. Some of them are even more complicated. Syria is more complicated because there are so many elements and so many parties there. But the danger in Syria is that either party, if it wins, there is going to be significant retaliation against the other. Again, great possible cruelty.
David Livingston Smith.
I'd like to, first of all, say thank you, Irvin, for mentioning Sudan. This is one of my big concerns, the situation in Sudan, and I'm continually trying to raise awareness of it. And people seem not to care. The world seems oblivious to the monstrous things going on in that country. It is really a genocide of attrition and a highly racialized genocide, as genocides tend to be, and shot through with dehumanization.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're speaking with Irvin Staub, David Livingston Smith, and John Kagg about the roots of political violence, the phenomenon of dehumanization, and the process of rehumanization and preventing future political violence. If we wanted to go back into this whole issue of dehumanization and the process of rehumanization, you've kind of made an assertion in your book that you think that there's something very natural and human about clinging to one's own. I wonder if, in fact, it has been socialized and if it can be socialized out by rehumanization process.
I think it's both. You see, I do think that we have a tendency to privilege our own. But what counts as our own, you see? This is the crucial question. The whole of humanity might count as one's own, or one's members of one's religion might count as one's own, or one's nationality, or one's tribe, or so on. So the boundaries of what you consider your in-group are immensely flexible, and this is a typically human characteristic, which makes it possible both for us to form alliances with others, to include them in our moral universe, but also to exclude them. I see this process of exclusion as the solution to a problem. And the problem is, as soon as we recognize others as fellow human beings, which we are all capable of doing, this activates inhibitions in us, inhibitions against harming them, and certainly against killing them. So that's why, by the way, killing other human beings is, for most people, very difficult. It's not like in the movies, right? It's psychologically challenging. I was just reading James Daw's book, Evil Men, and he's speaking to a Japanese veteran of the Nanjing massacre, and this man was saying they used to do bayonet practice on Chinese people who were tied to trees. So there was no danger to the Japanese recruit. They just had to approach the Chinese person and slip a bayonet into their heart, but they trembled with fear as they did it. This sort of thing is very, very difficult to do. But at the same time, it is obviously advantageous to do violence to others, materially advantageous on occasion. We can steal their stuff. We can enslave them. We can extend our territory and so on. So if you think about that, if you think that most normal human beings, psychologically normal beings, have inhibitions against performing these terrible acts, well, at the same time, these acts are advantageous or they're committed under duress on the part of governments and other powerful elites, then you see people are between a rock and a hard place. And I think that dehumanization is a solution to this problem. If we really conceive of others as subhuman creatures, then we're relieved from the moral burden which would cause us to have difficulty doing harm to them. Now, I said that there's something about dehumanization that comes readily to us, but that doesn't mean that it is not a social and a socialized phenomenon as well. The fact that it comes easily to us has led governments and their propaganda apparatuses to exploit that tendency, to whip up dehumanizing sentiment in order to get people to do things that they want them to do.
John Kagg, how does this fit in with the whole technological aspect?
As Dave is talking, I'm thinking that the way that technology allows modern militaries to kill at a distance allows individuals to take combatants as not genuinely human, but rather as pixelated characters, or in the case of drone operators, for example. What is interesting, however, is that drone operators still recount that they have a great deal of trouble doing the job that they're asked to do. I think that this, however, is going to become worse, not better, when it comes to modern warfare and modern technology, modern military technologies. David began his comments with saying that cruelty is doing something, you have to know what you're doing. And I think that what is necessary, at least in the case of modern military operations, maybe not in the case of genocide in Sudan, for example, but in modern military operations, is to underscore the way that responsibility is something that cannot be gotten around, and that responsibility is not something that you can work into or build into particular autonomous computer systems. This ability to reflect and to claim one's actions as one's own is a sort of precondition for cruelty, but it's also a precondition for morality. And if we are to maintain our moral bearing, I think it's necessary to maintain that warfare is distinctly human and that technology cannot sort of stand in for our normative judgments. And I think that there's a danger when we say something like drones eliminate collateral damage. We're coming very close to making a sort of category mistake. Technology is not smart. It's not necessarily good just because it's easy to use. And I think that there is the assumption that the mere use of certain types of technologies provide the moral justification for their use. And I think that's very dangerous.
John Kagg, there are a couple of things that you had said in your writing that I wanted to look at. There's something like 30% of them have some kind of psychological burnout, I think is what it was called. They have an existential crisis, I think was in one of your pieces. At the same time, we also know that something like 66% of Americans support this drone warfare overseas. But your concern kind of fit within the context of absolute power and what that does to a society, how it kind of creates a looseness of ethics and legal matters. Do you see that happening now?
Very recently, I think we've seen steps in terms of the drone program. It would seem that things are becoming a little more transparent, and I'm very happy about this. But I think that there is still a very great danger that as we acquire more power in terms of technological capabilities and that technology protects our citizens and citizen soldiers from harm's way, that there's a very real danger that we become alienated from the wars that we are fighting. Immanuel Kant in the late 1700s said that republics were good when it came to peace because their citizens bore some of the brunt of war. And because of this, they would put pressure on their leaders to avoid war. I think that what we found, at least with the recent drone campaigns, is that citizens place pressure on their leaders to protect them, to shield them from the costs of war. But with technology, this does not necessarily mean that this will lead to peaceful outcomes. Rather, it will lead to a type of sanitized war, at least sanitized for our own troops, safe for our own troops. But in no way will it assure peace or peaceful actions around the world. So that's a concern. And perhaps one other statistic is informative. When asked in 2012, a large group of Americans were asked where the majority of drone strikes occurred. Only 12% of people got the right answer. So drones and these types of technologies allow a citizenry to, in Irvin's words, to sort of just be bystanders and stand back. And I'm afraid that this will lead to what philosophers typically call the banality of evil, that evil acts are not created by particularly extraordinary ones, but by pathetically ordinary ones. And that the bystanders, as Irvin said, are complicit in the atrocities that go on in their name, but fairly quietly so.
Irvin Staub, I know you're working now and have a forthcoming book that deals with how to bring out sort of the good side of humanity, the moral side, the ethical side. We know from political science and international relations statistics that, in fact, war has diminished. It doesn't look like it when we see the news, but statistically, the numbers have gone down. The number of deaths have gone down, dying in war. So it is improving, but it sure still looks awful. If you were to look now across what we're facing as a humanity, and you've been working with people on the ground, what do you think are the most important things that need to be done?
I think one thing that needs to be done is to bring the humanity of people around the world close to us. As my fellow participants were just saying, technology creates a distance. When we create abstractions out of people, when we talk about thousands, when we look at large numbers, we don't connect to human beings. So how we can humanize the other, one of the important things to prevent violence by one group against another is on a group level to come to see the humanity of the other. In the individual level, some people get involved in violence, in a violent society, and many others don't. And the people who do get involved have certain characteristics. We can raise children in ways that they develop what I call inclusive caring. Many people want their children to care about the welfare of others, but limit that caring to people within the family or within their religious group or within their ethnic groups, maybe within their nation, but don't expand it beyond certain borders. And we actually train children that some people caring should not apply to certain people because they don't deserve it. So there are socialization practices, there are experiences in the family, there are experiences in the school, there are ways that children can be helped to connect with each other that can all develop this inclusive caring and also can develop moral courage. The morality and the caring that leads to the willingness to speak up and take action when other people are harmed, even in the face of opposition, even in the face of people in the environment who go along with that. So that moral courage, there is no research about courage in general. A lot of it is military people of different kinds. That shows that training and experience in being involved in courageous activities can increase courage. Children are often not encouraged to speak out, to take action that may lead their peers to not like them, that may say something to their teachers, that can have potentially negative consequences, even if these are morally relevant, important issues. We can actually help children to develop their voice, to develop their belief that it is okay to express what they think in positive ways, and to be morally courageous. And so through that, we are likely to create active bystandership that can move upward and influence people in positions of power. The trouble is that very often when people are in positions of influence and power and they have certain ideologies and they follow a leader, their moral values can be subverted by the pressures and influences within their circumstances. And instead, some other things like loyalty and obedience and a shared cause become extremely important for them. By raising children in ways, in families, in communities, in churches, and all kinds of places, that they are becoming the kind of people who can resist this subversion of their morality. When they get into positions of influence and power, we are likely to have better leadership. We are likely to have a better country.
Irvin Staub, I know you yourself are a Holocaust survivor. I also know that so many people in those situations where there is a culture of violence and a culture of cruelty, when they speak out, they don't often survive. Take Syria, for example, right now. It looks from here like a spree of killing on both sides.
Yes, there is a spree of killing. And Syria has become a situation that is extremely complex, extremely dangerous, and truthfully, it's very difficult to know what to do. If I was in a position of power, I would certainly work towards some kind of action. Maybe the action would simply be as a start to stop overflights so that the various groups cannot simply bomb from the air. But it is very challenging. But active bystandership is often challenging. You know, we have all kinds of heroes who make a difference coming back home. Many people don't know the name of Ron Reidauer. Ron Reidauer was a man who served in Vietnam. He was not at My Lai, where, as most people know, 300 to 500 people were killed, not fighters, villagers, civilians, women, children, and old men, by our troops. And Ron Reidauer trained with soldiers who were at My Lai, and he heard about this. And he couldn't stop until he made it sure that our country knew about this. He was the man through whom congressional investigations began, and Seymour Hersh started to write about it, and the country came to know about it. This was very unpopular. His fellow soldiers didn't like it, but he did what his conscience committed him to do, and as a result, there were less of these things happening later on, for sure. So the point is, I agree with you that these things are not easy to do. They can be dangerous, but if people act early, if they use their own mind and they process what is going on and make judgments about events and manage together with other people, and hopefully these are, you know, we are talking about governments also, manage to act early, the danger is less.
David Livingston Smith.
Of course, I can't disagree with what Irvin just said. No sane person could disagree with that. However, there is a complication. As we've noted already, we've both agreed, people who commit these atrocious acts often take themselves to be morally righteous and take themselves to be displaying moral courage. Heinrich Himmler, in his infamous Poznan speech, conveyed this, you know, very, very clearly. What we need to do, I think, and this connects with what John Kagg said, is to work against those processes by means of which human beings override their inhibitions against lethal violence. That is, we need to be intolerant, and this is actually a responsibility, I think, very much of the media. We need to be intolerant of dehumanizing rhetoric and other forms of speech and thought which make it easy for us not to care, to neglect the humanity of others, and indeed make it easy for us to inflict terrible harm on them.
John Kagg.
Very quickly, I'll follow up on David's point. I think that in our culture, it's very easy to think about goodness as being synonymous with easiness. And I think that what has come across through David and Irving's comments is that the good and the moral and the just is not easy. And that is something that I think is a fact that is going to run counter to our deepest intuitions, because we would like things to be easy, but that does not always mean that they are good. And in fact, the easiness of some act is oftentimes the sign that we have gone off the tracks, morally speaking, in a fairly dramatic sense.
Thank you very much for your very profound comments. Really appreciate you joining us and sharing your thinking and your research and logic with us. Irvin Staub, David Livingston Smith, John Kagg, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Irvin Staub is a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. His books include The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism, which is just coming out in paperback. David Livingston Smith is a professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He's the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, and Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. John Kagg is professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. He's the author of Neoconservative Images of the United Nations, American Domestic Politics and International Cooperation, and co-author of Philosophical Pragmatism and International Relations. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper-Nankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.